This edition of the week is sponsored by Invitrogen. Gibco Cell Culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.
This week, the case for patient-reported outcomes.
We know that adherence to that medical regimen is going to be in part driven by the patient's perception of benefit.
Hi, I'm Carrie Grenz, and you're listening to The Week, the weekly news podcast from The Scientist. In the magazine this month, Ed Silverman writes about the FDA's push for more patient-reported outcomes in clinical trials. They're expensive, time-consuming, and as Alexandra Quittner says, extremely valuable. Quittner is a psychology professor at the University of Miami, and she helps to develop patient surveys for use in clinical trials. I spoke with Quittner recently, and she explained to me what the FDA is hoping to get out of them.
I think that the FDA is focusing on chronic illnesses in which it's very important to examine the patient's perception of benefit as new treatments come online or new drugs are seeking approval. In a chronic illness situation, you are dealing day in and day out with an illness for long periods of time. And we know that adherence to that medical regimen is going to be in part driven by the patient's perception of benefit. And so I think that the FDA in part is recognizing the importance of the patient and the patient as a decision maker or at least a partner in his or her own health care, and so wanting to actually note whether the patient sees a new drug or a new treatment as beneficial.
And what about for acute conditions or those that are intermediate, some that might not be chronic, but might fall somewhere in between where, you know, they're living with a certain condition for a while? Would those work with patient-reported outcomes?
Well, I think acute illnesses, I mean, it's less clear, and they haven't, I don't think there are as many patient-reported outcomes that have been developed for acute illnesses. Now, there are some things that can be acute, such as pain, for which patient-reported outcomes have been the standard for many years. For example, the only way you really know if a new pain medication is effective is to ask the patient how he or she is perceiving changes in pain. So PROs have been used for decades in pain research and in approvals of pain medications. So that could be acute, that could be chronic pain, but clearly PROs have been very appropriate for pain conditions. I don't know if intermediate conditions, I can't think of many right off the top of my head, but what's really striking in terms of the shift in the prevalence of chronic conditions is that many medical conditions that were once terminal are now chronic. Cancer is a very good example. Quite a number of cancers are now treatable. They may reemerge in 5 to 10 years in another form, but a number of the major types of cancers are now considered chronic diseases rather than acute. Patient-reported outcomes in cancer trials have been part of the science of doing those trials for a long time. They may not have been the primary endpoint, but in cancer trials, patient-reported outcomes such as health-related quality of life have been a mainstay of cancer research. Other examples of diseases that were previously terminal that are now chronic are things like cystic fibrosis, which has a shortened lifespan, but we now have young children living with CF into adulthood, and that's considered a chronic illness with a life-shortening course. And so, again, patient-reported outcomes would be very appropriate.
Are there any conditions that you can think of that would not benefit from patient-reported outcomes, any therapies?
For example, if you had strep throat, if you had bronchitis, if you had an acute illness of a short duration, it might be helpful to know whether symptoms have improved when you're on the medication or a new drug has been approved for a particular type of infection. But, the mechanisms are really not in place to do those sorts of studies. And, typically I don't think that a lot of those kinds of studies have been done in acute conditions like a brief infection.
And it seems like there at least was, if not maybe still persists, some stigma against them because they're not physiological data with, you know, biochemistry attached to them. They're, you know, subjective information. But it seems now that there's this push through the FDA, and there's a quote from another source in there who says that he was a skeptic and now he's convinced. What do you think has changed in terms of understanding the value of patient-reported outcomes?
I think there are a few things that have changed. One, I think that that is somewhat of a misconception that physiological measures are quote-unquote objective, and therefore, you know, measurement is accurate and clear each and every time. That's not the case. For a vast majority of even physiological measures, there's a tremendous amount of error. So, for example, when an adolescent with cystic fibrosis does a pulmonary function test, a PFT, which has been the gold standard physiological measure for lung function for decades, there's a lot of the outcome of that test that is effort-dependent and skill-dependent. If the teen is not motivated to blow, if the teen isn't standing up and has a good posture, if the technician hasn't sort of standardized the instructions to the patient, that can be as subjective as anything. And you could get very different PFT results depending on how much effort the adolescent put into blowing into the machine. Similarly, height and weight. For kids who have endocrine disorders where, for example, they may have growth hormone difficulties and so they're measured on stadiometers to assess their height or changes in height during treatment, you have to have a particular protocol and a very standardized way of measuring height. There's a tremendous amount of error. And typically, you know, if a nurse puts one of these kids on a normal sort of piece of equipment to measure height and weight, the height will be very different than the trained endocrinologist who might put that same child on a stadiometer. So one of the issues is there are some misconceptions that anything that's physiological or comes out of a machine is completely accurate and it's measured without any bias. And that's actually not the case. The other thing that's changed, I think, is a recognition by the healthcare community and physicians in particular that patient-reported outcomes can be measured in reliable and valid ways, and that there are instruments which have been developed with very rigorous psychometric properties. And I don't think that physicians and the medical community in general is typically trained on psychometric theory and test development. And so they're not aware that there are procedures in place to make these PROs extremely rigorous and, you know, test-retest reliability can be established, internal consistency of the measure can be established, construct and predictive validity can be established. And so some of the skeptics, I think, just didn't have the background in psychometric theory and measurement development to really evaluate health-related quality of life instruments or PROs.
And you actually designed some of these. Can you tell me what goes into it?
It's a very lengthy process. The FDA's guidance is an excellent. They have a whole wheel of the measurement development process, and it's an iterative, long-term process in which first you begin with the population of interest, and that may include developmental considerations. Do you have children in you know as a target for the measure? Do you have adolescents? Do you have adults? And so you have to think developmentally about the population that you're going to be seeking instruments and items from. And then it's really a question of going, usually it begins in a more qualitative way with focus groups, structured interviews, and the generation of items that are relevant to measure the construct. From there, you actually write items, and you usually write a larger number of items than you plan to have at the end of your instrument development, and you then do what's called cognitive testing to test those items with patients, with respondents, and asking them the clarity of the item, whether they understand it, how they use the rating scale. So you're able to evaluate a lot of the properties of those items as you go along. Then you typically pair those numbers of items down into an instrument, and then you begin to do the psychometric testing. So it's a very long, involved process to actually develop a reliable, well-validated patient-reported outcome. And the FDA is very clear that the target of that measure has to be theoretically linked to the mechanism of action you're proposing for your drug or your intervention.
It seems like it would get complicated if it's a novel mechanism and you might not know from history with
that. That's true. You might not know, but obviously, you know, whether you're using a patient-reported outcome or a physiological outcome, you have to have some theory about the mechanism of action of a new drug in order to know, you know, what symptoms are you addressing and targeting? What do you expect to change in that patient after they've taken this new drug? And so you really have to address that, whether you're using a PRO or you're using a physiological endpoint. And really, my recommendation is that for chronic diseases, you use both. You should probably include both the kind of clinical physiological measures that are tied to the outcome you're expecting, as well as a patient-reported outcome.
And how long and how much does developing a PRO cost and take?
You know, the PRO that I've developed, I've been working on it for about 8 years. It was relatively inexpensive in terms of, you know, several hundred thousand dollars, clearly, to run some of these studies. One of the more expensive aspects of developing a PRO is determining the MCID, the Minimal Clinically Important Difference score. And so I did partner with Gilead in order to determine the MCID for the PRO I've developed in cystic fibrosis. And so that was a significant investment from the pharmaceutical perspective. On the other hand, I mean, I give the measure to anyone who requests it for free. It doesn't cost anything. I give it to nurses, healthcare providers, clinics, CF centers, and pharmaceutical companies. So it's provided for free to anyone who's interested, as well as the scoring criteria and the articles behind it.
What exactly is provided for free, this MCIB?
No, the measure itself, I provide, we've developed one for children, parents reporting on children with CF, and teens and adults with CF. And we're now downwardly extending the CFQR to preschoolers using pictures instead of written items. And the measure's provided to anybody who's interested for free. So, yes, there's certainly work and research involved in the development of an instrument. But it doesn't necessarily have to be an enormous expense, and I certainly provide my instrument for free to anyone who asks for it.
And so this would be an instrument that could be used for a number of different therapies for cystic fibrosis?
Yes. In fact, it's being used in a trial of a new enzyme which aids in digestion for cystic fibrosis, and so we're really looking at digestive symptoms, stomach ache, body image, weight gain. And it's being used in a number of trials of inhaled antibiotics, which are treating the lung infections for patients with cystic fibrosis. And so that same PRO is being used in a number of different trials, but of course, we're hypothesizing different outcomes. I mean, the inhaled antibiotics are focusing on an improvement in respiratory symptoms, whereas the enzyme developers are focusing on improvement in digestive symptoms and improvement in weight gain. Again, you need to go back to linking the PRO or any endpoint directly to the effect that you're proposing your drug will have.
And so assume that I am a small biotech and an instrument like yours isn't available. Maybe I'm looking at an antidepressant for adolescents or something like that. I don't know if one exists, such as you've developed for cystic fibrosis. Is it possible for me as a small biotech to garner those resources and to get this done in a reasonable timeline?
Well, you probably would need to partner with a psychologist, a PhD-level psychologist who's interested in health outcomes research, and there are many of those. And yes, it would take some time in order to develop an instrument. I mean, it would certainly take a couple of years if you're starting from the very beginning where you're trying to identify the domains of interest and the items that are appropriate for the instrument, and then going through all of the steps to validate it psychometrically. It would take a couple of years. It's very hard for me to estimate the cost. It really depends on the population, how available they are. I mean, cystic fibrosis is an example of a very difficult population to access because it's a fairly rare disease. Asthma, on the other hand, is very prevalent, and it's pretty simple to get children with asthma, teens with asthma, and adults with asthma to participate in studies. So it really varies depending on the health condition you're targeting.
Is there any that you can foresee that would be good to sort of preemptively prepare for? Any conditions such as asthma or maybe mood disorders?
What do you mean preemptively prepare for?
So people who are coming out with new therapies for cystic fibrosis can take advantage of what you've already developed.
Right.
Are there other conditions that you can see that would be sort of good targets to have these heroes sort of in hand, these metrics?
There are a number of, especially in the pediatric area, where, you know, a number of PROs have been developed for adults. So there are a number of patient-reported outcomes available for adults with cancer. There are a few available for pediatric patients with cancer. But, for example, we could certainly use PROs developed for children and adolescents with epilepsy, children and adolescents with sickle cell disease, children and adolescents with rheumatoid arthritis. There are a number of conditions for which it would be very helpful to develop appropriate PROs. They're much more rare in pediatric conditions. Not all psychologists have a developmental background, and it's very important if you're going to develop a PRO that will be administered to children that you have a background in child development so that you can write appropriately worded items.
That was Alexandra Quintner from the University of Miami giving us her take on the value of patient-reported outcomes in clinical trials. To read Ed Silverman's feature on PROs, pick up the October issue of The Scientist or read it online at thescientist.com. There you can also find articles from The Scientist Daily News and blogs from the writers and editors of The Scientist. That's all for our podcast this week. Thanks for tuning in.
This edition of The Week was brought to you by Invitrogen. Gibco Cell Culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.